I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.
Stately plump Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lather on which a mirror and a razor lay crossed. A yellow dressing gown, ungirdled, was sustained gently behind him by the mild morning air. He held the bowl aloft and intoned, "Inter vivo ad altare Dei." Halted, he peered down the dark winding stairs and called up coarsely, "Come up, Kinch! Come up, you fearful Jesuit!"
That's he came forward. How Ulysses starts. And it ends with a single word, "Yes." And in the 700-plus pages in between, James Joyce tells the story of two voyagers on the most ordinary and remarkable of days in Dublin, June 16th, 1904. 100 years on, Dublin, Ireland, Europe, the world, are all wildly different places, and that's as it should be. But one constant remains. Ulysses is still considered the greatest novel of the last 100 years. So, on the 100th anniversary of Bloomsday, the day Leopold Bloom and Stephen Dedalus met and wandered through Dublin, we're reassessing James Joyce's Ulysses and wondering why, a century later, we're still marking a day that only ever existed in one man's mind. Connection listeners, how is it that a book that so few have actually finished has kept a century-long lock on our collective imagination? If Ulysses is the domain of scholars, is Bloomsday, for the rest of us, a way of claiming a sliver of the vast, difficult masterpiece all for ourselves? How are you marking this Bloomsday? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call to join in the conversation. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we'll be joined in this hour by Colm Tobin, Irish novelist, most recently of The Master, and by James Wood, senior editor at The New Republic, whose latest collection of essays is called The Irresponsible Self, on comedy and the novel. But first, it is Bloomsday, and we've got to go to Dublin. So we are going to go to Davy Byrne's pub, and readers of Ulysses will recognize the pub as the spot where Leopold Bloom ate his lunch 100 years ago today. Gorgonzola sandwich, I believe. Sonia Shield from Rejoice Dublin 2004 joins us on the line from Davy Byrne's, where I'm told she spent the better part of her day. Sonia? Hello? Sonia? Hello? Sonia, are you there?
Sonia? Yes, I am.
Well, how are things down at Davy Byrne's?
Things are great down here at Davy Byrne's. There's a huge throng of people gathered outside the pub and inside the pub.
More than all
with a glass of burgundy in hand.
Oh, it has to no Guinness at all, just burgundy today?
Well, we're trying to switch the month to burgundy just for today. There's the odd pint of Guinness floating around as well.
Right. Well, could you pass us along then to Jim Maloney, please?
Yes, just one second.
Hi, hello, how are you?
I'm fine, Jim. How are you?
I can't complain. I'm a bit tired, but then that's expected. I've been working since 8 o'clock this morning, you know, getting things ready.
Not tired and emotional, just tired.
Oh, no, just tired. Worn out, you know.
Worn out, okay.
Worn out, do you know what that means?
Yeah, I do. Exhausted. So listen.
Yeah, I need a pint of Guinness right now.
Okay, well.
I need a pint of Guinness right now.
Chased with a glass of red burgundy, I assume. Now, Jim.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, I've already had that. You do that at 12 o'clock.
Oh, you did that at 12 lunch. O'clock.
Yeah, that's what the day is about. You can be all the way to here for lunch because that's what Leopold Bloom done. He arrived here at lunch and that was his lunch. A glass of burgundy and a slice of gorgonzola cheese and brown bread.
So,
a bit of mustard, you know?
Yeah, I do.
You're set up for the day.
Well, I'm glad you're set up
for the day then.
Jim, that's good. Now listen.
You had him, yeah.
Now Davy Byrne's is busy all the time, at least in part because it's mentioned in the book and you have literary tourists all the time in Dublin.
Very much so, yeah. Very much so, yeah. There's a plaque on the ground outside to commemorate the fact that Ulysses and Davy Byrne's are one and the same. Like, you know, the author drank in Davy Byrne's and Brendan Bean, who is his sister, brother-in-law, drank in Davy Byrne's. And the murals on the wall were done by another artist. They were all a clique, like, you know.
Yeah. Now, Jim.
It was an artist pub, like, you know.
It is.
Poets, writers, and painters.
But now, Jim, Jim, I'm going to ask you a very difficult question. Have you actually read Ulysses?
What's that?
Have you ever read Ulysses?
Sorry?
Did you read Ulysses?
Sorry, I can't hear.
Ulysses? Have you read Ulysses?
Are we in Duke Street?
Nah, Jim, listen, it, it,
It sounds like everybody's having a good time. Thanks very much. I think I'm going to have to call him after the show and find out if he read Ulysses. Anyway, let's carry on here and say hello to Colm Tobin. And you're out in San Francisco?
Yeah.
Hi, how's it going?
Avoiding Bloomsday.
you probably could go on the other side of the Pacific and be further away. But then, no, you'd be coming back towards Dublin if you got over to the other side. And hello to James Wood.
Hello.
Now, Colm, let me turn to you first. You grew up in Dublin.
No, I grew up in Wexford, but I came to Dublin when I was 17 to go to college, and I've lived there ever since. So I'm a sort of honorary Dubliner, although Dubliners are very snobbish about that.
And growing up and knowing that you probably knew that you were going to be a writer of fiction, what does a book like Ulysses mean to an Irish novelist?
Well, it adds enormous weight to certain elements of Irish experience. And it adds a great weight to living and a sort of lightness sometimes to living in the city. For example, if I go to lodge a cheque in my bank from where I live, I walk down Kildare Street past the National Library, where a scene in both Ulysses and The Portrait of the Artist took place. I turn around the corner into South Leinster Street, and I can see still written up on the wall, Finn's Hotel, the hotel where Nora Barnacle worked. It's no longer a hotel, but the sign is still up, which gave him the beginning of the title of Finnegan's Wake. When I turn around the corner then into Clare Street, I pass Sweeney's Chemist, which is still there, and you can still buy the lemon soap that Leopold Bloom bought in that shop. Now, you go around the corner into West End Row, and I mean, I should say that every time I go around the corner, I smile to myself at a terribly good joke that Leopold Bloom makes as he turns that corner. He's thinking about the consecration and the body and blood and the wine and the bread. And he thinks, wine, that was a good idea. They were right to pick wine. I mean, wine is a dignified sort of drink to change, you know, into the blood. I mean, it wouldn't be the same if it was ginger ale. And it's just a wonderful little moment where his mind is so wonderfully funny and so alert to things. And then because he's gone down into the church in Westland Row, which is the church you pass, and then you go in to do your normal business in the bank. It doesn't mean you think about it all the time or your mind is constantly on it, but it does add to that journey. Every so often, one of those elements comes into your mind. But so the whole business of Ulysses and the city, and the voices in the novel and the voices in the city, which coincide and echo against each other.
But the interesting thing is that, you know, Dublin, even 20 years ago, much of its attitude and atmosphere, I mean, Joyce wrote copiously and despairingly about his thoughts of Dublin, from which he was exiled for most of his adult life, and he wrote this book, which is all about the city from exile. I mean, Dublin has changed dramatically just in the last 10 years, 12 years. The Celtic Tiger miracle has turned Dublin into an international city and not a provincial capital at all. Do you find that it's harder to see for you? I mean, obviously, you know where to look, but if someone didn't know where to look, would they still get the feel of the imagined city of Joyce?
Well, no, you get layers. I mean, the nuns knocked down Eccles Street, where Molly Bloom lived, and they built a private hospital there. And then they had the nerve to put a plaque up on it. So, I mean, there are elements of pure comedy. I should say that Bloomsday has become part of the Celtic Tiger in the sense that it's now about tourism. It's now about everyone wants to have a party day and night. And a few years ago, I forgot it was Bloomsday, and I was coming out of the supermarket. And then I walked up the lane and ended up passing Davy Byrne's pub, and suddenly I realised, oh God, it's Bloomsday. They were all in Edwardian costumes and boating hats on, and they looked incredibly silly. And you see, the problem with Bloomsday is that no one knows who you are, because there's a man in the Macintosh who appears throughout Ulysses, and people often play him on Bloomsday by just wandering around the city on their own in a Macintosh all day. And people, I had two supermarket bags, and people stop and say, who are you? I mean, who are you playing from the book?
I'm just a man with two shopping bags, is the answer.
If you don't mind, I'm going home to go on my work. I'm just, you know, living in the now. But the party element of Bloomsday, for example, there was no celebration of the book at all until 1954. In other words, the country was dead economically and was ashamed of the book at the same time. They sort of fed into each other. And the fact that now there's a massive party, everyone loves the book, is sort of part of the general euphoria and optimism that has arisen from the place just bubbling and bursting with money.
James Wood, the Ulysses of the mind, is the Ulysses that takes place in the real city of Dublin. When you were young and first reading it, how did you approach it?
I approached it in the way I think you ought to, and as a result, actually, only got about halfway. I was a teenager, which is without the medium of commentary. There's now, as you know, a massive industry, and there are some incredibly useful books like Gifford's annotated Ulysses. But I think there's something to be said for just ploughing in, losing a lot of it, and seeing where you can go. I'm glad that that Colm mentioned that thing of walking down a street and remembering something and smiling in joy. I once had an argument with a pretty famous English critic, professor, who was no fan of Ulysses, and he said, well, it seems to me to fail the test. And I said, well, what's the test? He said, the test is that a phrase, unbidden, comes into your mind walking down the street. And I said, well, actually, plenty do from Ulysses say that great phrase about the buzzing prongs of a fork, which is, I think, that phrase comes up actually in the pub at lunchtime. But just in terms of laughter, what makes me laugh again and again when I'm in a church is Joyce's joke about muscular Christianity, seeing Father Coffee deciding he looks like a bit of a bully and then saying, muscular Christian.
Let me quickly play that section now.
They halted by the bier, and the priest began to read out of his book with a fluent croak. Father Coffee. I knew his name was like a coffin. Damini Namini. Bully about the muscly looks. Bosses the show. Muscular Christian. Woe betide anyone that looks crooked at him. Priest, thou art Peter. Bursts sideways like a sheep in clover, Dedalus, as he will, with a belly on him like a poisoned pup. Most amusing expressions that man finds. Burst sideways. Non intres in judicum conservo tuo domine. Makes them feel more important if he prayed over in Latin. Requiem mass. Crepe weepers. Black edge notepaper. Your name on the altar list. Chilly place, this. What to feed well, sitting in there all the morning in the gloom, kicking his heels, waiting for the next, please. Eyes of a toad, too. What swells him up that way? Molly gets swelled after cabbage. Air of the place, maybe. Looks full up of bad gas. Must be an infernal lot of bad gas around the place. Butchers, for instance. They get like raw beefsteaks. Who was telling me? Mervyn Brown. Down in the vaults of St. Werburgh's, lovely old organ, 150, they have to bore a hole in the coffin sometimes to let out the bad gas and burn it. Out it rushes, blue. One whiff of that, and you're a goner.
The great Irish actor Jim Norton reading from Ulysses. We're coming up to the break, Connection listeners. After the break, we'll be talking a bit more about Bloomsday. Maybe we'll kind of deconstruct this passage. Deconstruct, that means analyze this passage and discuss how we juxtapose Latin, the mass, and bad cabbage giving you wind. How are you celebrating Bloomsday? Do you celebrate Bloomsday? What's your favorite bit of Ulysses? There's a lot to choose from. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, the number to call to join in the conversation with novelist Colm Teuben and James Wood. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. It's Bloomsday. 100 years ago today, something happened in real life. James Joyce went out on his first date with Nora Barnacle, the woman he married. And somehow this date, his love letter to her, to mark the anniversary, was this enormous book, Ulysses. And we were just hearing before the break a long reading that pretty much sums up the ability of Joyce in this book to do something I'm not sure that anyone else had ever done quite so well at that point, which was get inside the actual flow of thought that goes through your mind in the most mundane situations, James.
Yeah, it's no one had done it as well. I think that's true. There had been before this kind of writing something close to it in third-person narration, which is known as free and direct style. And the difference between free and direct style and omniscient narration is easily put this way. I think David Lodge has a thing in which he... Omniscient narration is something like this. Cinderella looked at the clock and saw that it was midnight and time to go. Free and direct style, and we already see the Joycean, it sounds like Joyce, is something more like Cinderella looked up, 12, time to go. Now, writers were doing that. You can find that even in Jane Austen. And it had reached a real level of complexity, I think, in Henry James, in Chekhov. But to do what Joyce did, to be that much more daring, to chop up the sentences, a great tactfulness, actually, because you leave a great deal to the reader to piece together. It's what Hugh Kenner called the aesthetic of delay. It's not until 20, 30 pages later you begin to think, aha, I know why he talked about the organ. Or, I mean, for instance, in this passage, Father Coffey goes to, I knew his name was like a coffin. Then about 3 pages later we get the great joke, the Irishman's house is his coffin. And it's this continual associative. Wonderful.
Colm, when you first read the book, how old were you? And were you able to peel away the layers as James just had in a passage like that?
It's very easy to peel away the layers when Bloom's mind is working. There are other times in the book, for example, you always want to know what the connection with Homer is and what those small connections are. Obviously, there's a much better annotated edition now. I think one of the things about Joyce and Ulysses is that modernism for Joyce was an imperative, whereas for others it seems like a luxury. In other words, there was no possibility that an Irish novelist working in those years within the chaos of Ireland, where there was no layered society as in England or France, there was no possibility of manners and morals and choice and chance becoming the theme of a novel which would end happily in a marriage, for example. There's no Irish novel which ends in a marriage. And therefore, out of the chaos of that society, which was in a state of great flux because it was clear the British were going to go, but unclear what would take over. It was clear the Catholic Church was there to be mocked. The sort of nationalist movement was there to be mocked. And what was there to be celebrated in the middle was something that no one in Ireland of those years thought worth celebrating, which was a Jewish man wandering the city, not much work, meeting layabouts, people who sat around pubs singing, a great amount of singing in the thing, a great amount of laying about, sitting in pubs, people just being very witty for no particular reason. And that level of the way the chaos is dealt with in the book, the chaos of how the mind works, how the mind's a monkey, working one thing, another thing occurring, bits and pieces, going into a mass, looking at it for a bit, thinking this, walking out, thinking about sex, thinking about religion. All of that was an imperative in the sense there was no other way for a novelist to function except in some of Joyce's contemporaries becoming great talkers or great drinkers. But there was no other way out. You couldn't write a realist masterpiece in Ireland in those years.
But that's what's interesting, because I think as the years have gone by, the decades have gone by, the book, everybody approaches it differently. It exists. I mean, you get to it when you're a teenager, if you're very bookish. You might get to it later on if you're in university reading English. At this point in time, we read it for the stylistic innovations, but that it's hard to remember that it is also a social novel and that the people who are being written about weren't necessarily the people about which literature was concerned in the 19th century, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. They're also quite clever, a lot of them. I mean, the things they say. And also, I think the novel is very much written in sections. You know, that Molly Bloom's soliloquy is not like any other part of the book. And say that, for example, the section Cyclops deals so funnily with fundamental issues being debated in those years in Ireland about the nation, about, you know, what represents being an Irish, what being an Irish person is, and coming around with very, very good jokes where, for example, when Bloom says that Jesus was a Jew, one of the men says that that's blasphemous. God almighty, I'll crucify the fellow that said that. And that just that sense all the but there are other things as well that are worth pointing out. For example, in the middle of the book, there's a big list of priests. It's in the Cyclops section. And for any Irish reader, it's very, very funny. It's like what you read in provincial papers. They're all given their full titles, Monsignor this and Canon that. And it's like the list of people who go to Gatsby's party. But Only an Irish reader can get the full implications of the jokes within that. And there are many other jokes in the book that you just wonder. Poor old Virginia Woolf sitting in Bloomsbury, trying to read that list of priests, you know, Father Paddy Maloney, P.P., Canon Moriarty, S.J., and going on, say, what could he possibly be talking about? But for any Irish reader, you just realise this is a provincial Irish paper, and whatever way he's chosen the names, and whatever way he's modulated the list, it's extremely funny for Irish ears, but it couldn't work in South Korea, right. And it certainly couldn't work in Bloomsbury.
James, just explain to us the Leopold Bloom character in the book. It's remarkable to centre the book on a Jewish man living in Dublin, not necessarily a place with a lot of Jewish people living there.
No, indeed, a larger community than the now, but never big. Well, you know, there's a lot we can say about the choice. I mean, Joyce was interested and deeply sympathetic to the notion of the diaspora Jew, anyway, and of course it makes a sort of literary sense if we're considering a novel written outside Ireland. To choose, I mean, he said, I need a foreigner for this. If you think, Colm is exactly right about the ways in which this novel connects to the 19th century realist novel, and one way it connects to late 19th century and early 20th century romanticism is the whole notion of the flaneur, that you send out a character, a sort of porous scout, who goes out and simply absorbs details, sensations, reflections in a way, a walking mirror. The Baudelaire idea. It's probably right that if you're going to do that, you want someone who's not quite inserted into the society. You want a sort of natural alienation, a slight tilt, and the Jewishness provides that.
He's introduced in the book in the most remarkable way. He's introduced essentially through his quite interesting tastes at the table.
Mr. Leopold Bloom ate with relish the inner organs of beasts and fowls. He liked thick giblet soup, nutty gizzards, a stuffed roast heart, liver slices fried with crust crumbs, fried hen cod's roes. Most of all, he liked grilled mutton kidneys, which gave to his palate a fine tang of faintly scented urine. Kidneys were in his mind, as he moved about the kitchen softly, writing her breakfast things on the humpy tray. Gelid light and air were in the kitchen, but out of doors, gentle summer morning everywhere. It made him feel a bit peckish. The coals were reddening. Another slice of bread and butter. 3, 4. Right. She didn't like a plate full. Right. He turned from the tray, lifted the kettle off the hob, and set it sideways on the fire. It sat there, dull and squat, its spout stuck out. Cup of tea soon, good. Mouth dry. The cat walked stiffly round a leg of the table, with tail on high.
Meow.
Oh, there you are.
Yes. Turning from the fire. The character of Bloom, Colm, how affecting is he to you, after what I assume several readings of the novel?
Well, he has a wonderful mind. He notices things most beautifully. I mean, I think the importance of him is the rich way in which he notices things. And, you know, that he's also, there's a level of sensuousness which would have been much more difficult had the, for example, the protagonist been a Catholic in the city. That there would be always that business of confession and guilt or even deep rebellion, you know, in Stephen's case. But because Bloom is Jewish, Joyce is allowed to make him much more sensuous, much less guilty. And, you know, he's also extremely funny. The whole business of the music of the book, of the music of Bloom's mind, I think is very important. One thing you discover about Irish writers is that a great number of them, from James Joyce to John Banville, began as singers. A friend of mine interviewed James Joyce's sister Eileen, who was also a great singer. And she asked her, Eileen, what was his voice like? And she said, oh, well, Jim was a great singer, you know. He had a great tenor voice. And he said, but what was he like in relation, say, to John McCormack? Oh, she said, John McCormack was a better singer, but when our Jim sang, it broke your heart. And there is that sense of the way music fills the book, not only just songs and the fact that Molly's a singer, but also the music of the prose, the way in which a single word sentence is followed by something else, a bit of Latin, a bit of other things being noticed. And so that there's also the sadness of Bloom, which has to be remembered. He's very much a character out of an Irish novel. In other words, his father committed suicide. Incidentally, I think I slept in that room of the Queen's Hotel in Ennis one night. Couldn't sleep at all. And someone said to me, this is where, it's where Leopold Bloom's father committed suicide. You can still stay in the Queen's Hotel in Ennis. His father's committed suicide. His son is dead. His wife is having an affair with somebody else. And he's moving in the city. And there is always haunted by Rudy's death, by the father's suicide, by being a cuckold. All that's there too. So he's many faceted in that sense. But the main issue is how beautiful his glittering mind is, how richly he notices things and remembers.
800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Sandy is calling from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Yes. Hi. Happy Bloom's Day.
Happy Bloom's Day.
I just have a couple of comments. One is, 30 years ago, I named my used bookshop Daedalus in Stephen's honor, and I named my first daughter Molly Bloom. Secondly, I can remember very clearly on the north shore of Long Island, Riverhead, opening a copy of Finnegan's Wake, thinking it was a very nice book, and then astonishingly, there was his signature. I can remember a girlfriend making a meal of the inner organs of various beasts. And I also remember, and still do, really, really hate Blazes Boylan. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for that comment, Sandy. James, you're laughing.
I'm laughing because the intensity of the identification with Bloom, and indeed Colin was doing it also, the wonderful way of running together life and fiction. I slept in the room where I think it's the greatest possible tribute, isn't it, to his vivacity as a character. And one of the things I completely agree with Colin about this, the liveliness of the mind. It's worth saying, of course, and I don't, it sounds like I'm wanting to pull down the party if I say this, I'm not at all. But I think we always accept in this kind of fiction, that's to say the stream of consciousness or flaneur style notation of the world, that a fudge is going on. The fudge being that an ordinary character is seeing and absorbing things, and then that is then passed through an extremely unordinary mind, the writer's. So that, for instance, when Bloom walks past a pub and the old beer is being thrown out from the night before, and Joyce simply writes in stream of consciousness, the flabby gush of porter. It's a fabulous phrase, and I think instinctively we know it to be Joyce's in a way. And yet part of the beauty of the fudge is that we can then bestow that phrase on Bloom and feel that it's Bloom's voice too. And that's a sort of magic that can go very wrong.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. We're talking today about James Joyce's Ulysses on the 100th anniversary of Bloom's Day. Connection listeners, we characterize the book as the monument of the last 100 years in English language fiction. It still comes top of most critic lists of the greatest novel of the 20th century. But I wonder, does it still have the same impact? Perhaps all this talk of Bloom's Day passes you by. Connection listener, do you think that James Joyce, who was once the hallmark of what it meant to be a modern writer, now really belongs to the past? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call. Colm, what do you think about that notion? I mean, you approach a mountain from one direction, but the sun goes down on the other side. Perhaps he's not quite the modern icon that he seemed 50 years ago.
I think the book is still an amazing book to read. I think it manages very well to create that fictional universe almost from the beginning that you believe this is Bloom's mind. and that you follow it, and that you don't every so often say, oh God, this is clearly a writer trying to enter into, this is a writer cleverer and more sensuous. I think it's very difficult for a writer to create a character who notices less than the writer notices.
Absolutely.
And who feels less and whose sensuousness is less than the writer's. It's a really hard thing to know what to leave out in the noticing business.
Yes.
And I think what Joyce does is he creates an ordinary universe for Bloom. And I think this is what really irritated people because, for example, Joyce went not to Trinity College, which is, you know, the set up under Elizabeth I. It's a posh place. He went to the Catholic University. And Professor Mahaffey of Trinity College, when he read the book, said it was proof, if we needed proof, that this university set up was a mistake, that the corner boy should have been left on the corner measuring the length of their spit instead of being slightly educated up there. And this is Ulysses is the result. And, you know, Virginia Woolf's response to it is more or less the same. In other words, this ordinary business, these awful people wandering around these pubs, you know, where she was doing Clarissa, she was getting posh people to notice things poshly and sort of glamorously, whereas poor old Joyce remained with the business of trying to get ordinary life and denote it and calibrate it and play with it so that ordinary life sort of glitters in a way that doesn't happen. You know, that ordinary life in George Gissing, for example, is all down. Poor people are sad. Poor people barely notice. Poor people are miserable. Thomas Hardy's poor. They're all miserable. Joyce is poor, always laughing, shouting, saying funny and very bitter things. And Bloom's poverty is not a poverty of the imagination or the poverty of the noticing business. It's just that he doesn't have much money.
James, I wonder, we're coming up to the break. This is probably the wrong time to ask this, so think about this question. In reading the book, though, because it is patterned after the incidents in the Odyssey, is it possible to fully understand the book without also knowing the book to which it refers?
I think it is, but I think a condition of reading it is to be thinking that you're continually managing your own incomprehension, so that you're always getting about 60-65% of the layering and the illusion.
Connection listeners, have you tried to read this book? When was the last time you tried to read this book? It's certainly something that you can come back to every decade of your life. Have you tried that? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is the James Joyce Connection on the 100th anniversary of Stephen Dedalus and Leopold Bloom's day-long wandering around Dublin, Bloom's Day. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Eileen is calling from East Lansing, Michigan.
Hello.
Hello, Eileen.
Hi.
You're on the air.
I was calling to answer the question as to whether Ulysses was still readable and modern and current, or should be relegated to the past. And I think it's very current. I think the voice, the writer's voice in it, is always immediate, even if the story is about 1904. I think that's true of only really great novels, that the voice in it stays immediate, as though the writer is right there with you. And it often surprises me still, and I've read it a number of times. In fact, I had a group of us just to read every single word of it, rather than bits of it or skimming it. And he always surprises me. When I read through it, there's always something that just startles me.
What sticks in your memory?
The description at the end of the scene, the chapter where they're in the whorehouse in Nighttown, mm-hmm. and he's trying to get Stephen a ride home on the Jarvie, or the Jarvie won't give him a ride home, and you hear the jingling of the horse bells, and you have this Torralora Loom description in the paragraph, which is so apt because it's Dublin. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous paragraph. It just absolutely stabs you. It's so beautiful. The chapter before Molly Bloom's soliloquy is like a study in a man's denial of what is emotionally tearing him apart. It's, if I read it realizing his emotional state, it's just almost painful. It's beautifully written, and it's, of course...
You're talking about the sequence, which is essentially a debrief in which...
Exactly.
What is that section called, column? Is that Nestor? That section, just before
Nestor,
the... It's called Nestor. And it's interesting, Eileen, that you choose that passage, because when all is said and done, that's actually my favorite passage of the book as well.
Really?
It is... an extraordinarily, I think, first of all, it's experimental. Let's tell listeners who maybe don't remember the book, haven't read the book. Basically, Colm, why don't you explain it, Colm Tobin?
You'll have to remind me what it is. Is this a scene where they go back to the house?
They go back to the house.
And Molly is there?
And Molly's upstairs in bed already.
And Bloom's got Stephen and Molly.
Yeah, Bloom's got Daedalus with him, and... You know, perhaps Daedalus is the worse for wear.
There's a whole possibility of Bloom, Stephen, Molly, Bloom being interested in Stephen's response to Molly. But
it's also, Eileen, remind us again what moves you about this?
I think this is chapter 17.
Yeah.
And it's a question and answer. It's very, very emotionless. The denial of his emotional undoing, that he has been devastated, as we find out through the death of his baby, through Molly's finally having an affair, and this is a handout not letting any kind of emotional message in. It just feels very emotionally denying what is hurting him. And I thought it was just the most striking method of using it. It does all sorts of work, too. It gives you all sorts of information, and it gives you an emotional state that's very, very hard to render.
Yeah. Eileen, thanks for your call. I'm going to put these points to James Wood here in the studio.
Well, one of the things that I love most about stream of consciousness and this great refinement of free and direct style is that it's a way of registering what goes into the mind, but it's also a way of registering how the mind is actually absent too. It's a shame, it's a great shame for those of us who love Virginia Woolf that she didn't appreciate Ulysses, though as in all Woolf's comments, there are actually some other interesting comments. I mean, that suggest something of a slightly mollified attitude towards the book, and Woolf felt that way. You know, Woolf was intensely competitive and was writing off was very competitive with Catherine Mansfield and Eliot too. But for those of us who love Woolf, it's a great shame because in both writers there's a mastery of the way in which the mind can be processing. Information, sensations, memories, and so on, but actually be somewhat decentered from itself, begin to be moving away from the centre. And Colm was right when earlier he was talking about Bloom's pain. Quite often in this book, he's adrift. He's noticing intensely, but he's adrift, in fact.
What's moving about this, and I think this is what Eileen was referring to, is that by asking questions and then describing it factually the birth and then death of Molly and Leopold's only son,
yes,
in these terms, I'm just going to pick up in the middle of the sentence because it's a long sentence. Only male issue, deceased, 9 January 1894, age 11 days. There remained a period of 10 years, 5 months, and 18 days during which carnal intercourse had been incomplete without ejaculation of semen within the natural female organ, as if taking a medical history,
yes,
or a police statement. And it's a device. It's completely artificial, of course, but it brings with it a sadness. Colm is right to say that the thing that makes Leopold Bloom so compelling, Colm, is that he's the most unbearably sad man whose mind is still bravely making jokes, working as poetry. And this just lays it all out without any emotional comment either from the author or from the man who's experienced this pain. And it is really a quite extraordinary feat, and a daring one, too, because I don't think that is as that is tremendously experimental stuff.
Yeah.
Colm.
Yes, it's stylistically daring, but what's come before is very interesting, that Joyce is very good on the truth of things, on the truth of how the mind works, how the mind notices and remembers. so that the death the death of Rudy is mentioned constantly, but in the way grief works, in half a thought as you're wandering the street, it comes back into your mind and goes again, replaced by something else. It's not, in other words, it'd be very easy for a novelist to suddenly start telling the story of Rudy in the middle of the book and go into a flashback and describe how it all happened and then have Bloom moving on into another place. It doesn't work like that, the mind, and the book doesn't work like that either. But then he needs constant stylistic change in the book, that every chapter has to have its own sort of music. And the book gets, I think, as he writes it, it gets more and more interesting stylistically, more and more experimental stylistically. You can see the change, clearly written over a decade, as his mind, I think, is thickening, and his experience is also thickening. So that by the end, he's trying any trick from the long, the long sentence monologue, as the end, the interview, the extraordinary nighttown sequences, which are stylistically so interesting. I think the book actually develops stylistically, and he found that interview technique, I think, obviously really helpful in getting the information across, still trying to be true to experience in some way or other, that the only way Bloom could deal with this was A, indirectly, and then B, stylistically, this sort of strange question and answer, which is slightly like almost a courtroom, or in some cases a catechism.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. James.
I agree. Ending, of course, with the fantastic soliloquy. It's no accident, is it, that Shakespeare is the great presiding presence in this book, because Shakespeare is the great exception to everything. It's absolutely true that until really the beginning of the 20th century, the idea of writing this way about ordinary characters, allowing them their thoughts and voices, was an unusual one. George Eliot has to apologize for representing ordinary speech. Forster is anxious in The Longest Journey in the same way. You do get it in Hardy, you do get it in Lawrence, and you fantastically get it in Ulysses. But Shakespeare is the great exception. Shakespeare is the think of the soliloquy of Mistress Quickly, and what we see when we look at Stream of Consciousness is, unsurprisingly, that Stream of Consciousness is really soliloquy turned inward. That it was all there in Shakespeare. If you go to not all there, but if you go to Henry IV, Part Two, there's a great passage in which Mistress Quickly is challenged by Falstaff. She maintains that she lent him 30 shillings, and Falstaff said, "No, you didn't. I was never there." And she suddenly lets out this fantastic Molly-like monologue, completely full of irrelevances. And obviously, Shakespeare was an enormous presiding presence for Joyce.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Sinbar is calling from Columbia, South Carolina.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm Dublin, born and raised. I was born in 1942 there, and even though that was much later than Joyce's time, I still remember the magic and the razor-sharp wit of just about every Dubliner you could come across. And, it was reflected in the Brendan Beans and the BODs and the, the characters like that were all over the place. And my contribution is very simple. It's I had a bumper sticker made for myself, which is a pun on the biblical expression, rejoice and be glad, and mine reads, read, joyce, and be glad. And I thought, anybody who would like to take up that idea in, remembrance of Bloom's day, that it would be just a great way of propagating the the remembrance of this great artist. And I'm a part of Dublin in the rare old times, as the song says, you know.
Sinbar, thanks very much for that call. Colm.
I'm interested in that business of Shakespeare as the presiding genius of the book, who comes into the book over and over and whose influence is on the book over and over. The other presiding presence is the city of Trieste. That if I had to be anywhere today, I'd love to be there. Because how did Joyce educate himself so that he moved from writing Dubliners and the portrait to writing Ulysses? What happened to him in the years? And what happened to him was Trieste. That Trieste was the main port for the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It was the second city of the north of Italy. So that every show that went on in Vienna or in Milan came then to Trieste. Joyce went out every night to the theatre. He saw all the futurist shows. He saw every experimental show. He went three times to things. He went to the opera all the time. He met great numbers of people who spoke five or six languages in the city. Mm. And the city was his great educator. And there's a recent book by John McCourt about Joyce in Trieste, which shows very much that he met every bloom you could imagine, every version of him, among his students as a teacher and among his neighbours. And he also learned a great deal about modernism and about what you could do now in both fiction and the theatre in the city, in that city, in those years. So while Dublin is this sort of obvious city, there's a second shadow, which is the shadow of Trieste.
Colm, I want to thank you for joining us. Colm Tobin is the Irish novelist. He was on a line from San Francisco. James Wood, senior editor at The New Republic, and his latest collection of essays called The Irresponsible Self on Comedy and the Novel. Thanks for being in the studio with me, James. We could have gone on another hour, and I'd have been extremely happy, but time is coming to an end, and there's only one way to end a discussion of Ulysses, and that is to listen to Molly herself. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.
When I put the rose in my hair like the Andalusian girls used, I shall I wear a red, yes. And how he kissed me under the Moorish wall, and I thought, well him as another. And then I asked him with my eyes to ask again, yes. And then he asked me, would I, yes, to say yes, my mountain flower. And first I put my arms around him, yes, and drew him down to me so he could feel my breaths all perfume, yes. And his heart was going like mad, and yes, I said, yes, I will.